Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, with OCMIN, the meeting of the Australian and UK Defence and Foreign Affairs Ministers anticipated soon, Head of the ANU National Security College, Professor Rory Medcalf, and Royal United Services Institute Senior Research Fellow, Vilen Nuens, discuss how the two countries could increase the impact of their ongoing collaboration in the Indo-Pacific, exploring ideas drawn from their recent policy options paper, Australia and the United Kingdom, an Indo-Pacific security agenda for a revitalised partnership. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
So welcome to the National Security Podcast for 2022, our very first episode. And this episode, we're going to be looking at the strategic relationship between Australia and the United Kingdom, a topic that until recently wasn't particularly pertinent, it seemed, in global or Indo-Pacific security affairs. But in the last year, in 2021, of course, particularly with the announcement of the AUKUS submarine and other technology arrangement with Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom, and with Britain's so-called tilt to the Indo-Pacific and the publication of its integrated review, we've had some pretty significant indications that Britain is taking the Indo-Pacific seriously, that the relationship between Canberra and London is suddenly becoming one of those partnerships to be studied and to be encouraged in protecting Australia's security interests. So I'm really pleased to be joined today by a prominent voice in the strategic debate in the United Kingdom and indeed across Europe. And that's my friend and colleague, Vilen Nuens, who I've known for many years and who is at the Royal United Services Institute, a senior research fellow in Asia studies. We're going to be speaking not only about AUKUS and the Australia-UK relationship, but what it means in the Indo-Pacific and what realistic expectations of that can be. And the timing of this is not coincidental, of course, because we anticipate that quite soon it's likely Australian and British ministers will meet in the so-called AUKMIN Defence and Foreign Policy Ministers meeting, 2+2 meeting. Vilen, welcome to the National Security Podcast here at the National Security College.
Thank you, Rory. Pleasure to be here.
So I want to begin our conversation by noting also that we convened a dialogue last year in 2021 looking at the prospects for the Australia-UK strategic relationship in the Indo-Pacific. And we've been collaborating on a research paper, which we look forward to publishing very soon. So the ideas we're going to discuss today are, I guess, a little bit pre-cooked, but I still want to make this something of a spontaneous conversation. I'd like to begin by hearing your take on what's Britain doing in the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been really a sea change, I think, in strategic focus for the UK. This is not necessarily simply limited to, I think, discussions and then the emerging integrated review that Was released last March, March 2021. But I think it's a greater signal of focus towards the Indian Ocean region and the Pacific Ocean region and all the littoral states in which the UK has allies and partners, where the UK really sees a need to be more present. I think there's been somewhat of a misunderstanding that this is simply because of Brexit, that because the UK has left the European Union formally, that it therefore needs to all of a sudden have a renewed approach to the wider world under the banner of Global Britain. To a certain extent, that is, of course, true. It is looking to formalize and to strengthen and deepen some of these relationships, particularly in areas of trade. But I think a lot has happened over the past few years. If we look at just 4 or 5 years ago, the relationship with China, for example, was incredibly different. You know, in 2015, we saw the era, the golden era, so-called, of relations between the UK and China, with a visit of President Xi Jinping, you know, where a lot was promised in terms of trade. We haven't necessarily seen that emerge. And in the meantime, of course, we've seen a very assertive China come onto the global stage in the Indo-Pacific region in particular, which has, of course, spurred other partners like the US and Japan, and indeed also Australia, to recognize this as a strategic arena that is of direct importance to the UK for its national security. And I think with COVID, this has also been really exemplified in the fact that supply chain security, issues around new technology have all come to the fore as ways in which I think countries are reimagining what national security really is. That there is no real distinction between at home and abroad, and that that line is becoming very blurred indeed. And so what the UK has done is to really reassess what its national security focus is, where its priorities lie, and how this also relates to the Indo-Pacific region. So in the Integrated Review for Security, Defense, Development, and Foreign Policy, which I mentioned earlier, which it released in March last year, it noted specifically an Indo-Pacific tilt, and it outlined a broad framework. An accompanying defense command paper was also released shortly afterwards, in which it looked at some of the defense assets that the UK would send or be able to deploy towards the region for a persistent presence. These all, I think, are an indication that economically, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of UK national security, the Indo-Pacific region is really of prime importance to the UK. But there are, of course, challenges as well, and we can certainly go into that later, Rory, in terms of finances and budget, particularly in a post-Brexit and post-COVID world, or mid-COVID world as we are in right now. And then, of course, in terms of strategic priorities closer to home, with Russia still being a real and acute threat to UK national security.
Mid-COVID world, that's a disturbing phrase that I don't think I've heard before, but it's kind of frighteningly obvious. Thanks for that. Can I ask a little bit more about the practicalities of this British engagement before I move on to Australia's Indo-Pacific outlook and how these two might mesh? You know, you've mentioned, for example, that this isn't just rhetoric. This is about the defence footprint. For example, of the UK armed forces, and so we've seen in 2021, you know, quite strikingly, if I can say, the deployment to this region of a British carrier strike group, you know, very substantial naval force focused around, you know, one of the two aircraft carriers, the two, you know, next generation aircraft carriers in the Royal Navy, which I guess in some ways raises expectations about what the Royal Navy can and will do in the Indo-Pacific. Can you comment a little bit on that aspect?
Sure. The Carrier Strike Group was, I think, a real flagship initiative and symbol of the UK's foreign policy and footprint in the region. It, of course, did not only have a defence element to it, but also an economics and trade element to it, and then also a diplomatic, symbolic, I think, aspect that show to partners in the region that the UK could be present globally. And in that sense, you know, we saw the Carrier Strike Group be not only just a national initiative around the Queen Elizabeth carrier, but also with component parts of the Netherlands, which sent along a frigate, and then also, of course, the United States, which sent F-35s, as well as additional vessels. So I think for the UK, this was a major moment. It showed that the UK is serious and interested in the region and serious about being present. But I think more than that, you know, the question is what comes next after this? So we've seen a very successful visit. What can the UK do more? The Royal Navy, I think it's fair to say, is stretched. It will have a dip in hull numbers over the years to come whilst others come online. When you have to balance the need between being present in your own neighborhood and then being present further afield, which I think to, of course, taxpayers can be a little confusing sometimes or not very well understood, that becomes both a political and an actual physical dilemma. We see smaller initiatives, therefore, being proposed and actually being lived up to. So the UK in the Defence Command paper, for example, mentioned that it would have two OPVs, offshore patrol vessels, in the Indo-Pacific over the next 5 years. They won't have a home base necessarily, but the ambition there is to really have a cost-effective and flexible presence in the region, which is significant, to help with things like monitoring, surveillance, and capacity building of partners. We see the proposal of the Littoral Response Group South, which will be an amphibious element of the UK's presence or persistent presence in the region, which will start in 2023. And then, of course, later in the decade, the Defence Command paper noted that it will look towards Type 31 frigates being in the region as well. But I think, you know, there will be naysayers that say that this is an insignificant, minor presence. And I think we have to be realistic in that sense, that the UK won't be a leading player in the Indo-Pacific in a defense sense. You know, I think that is something that is still more suitable and more appropriate for countries in the region itself that are there permanently with a larger capability. But the UK can play a really important diplomatic and supporting role in defense. And I think that is what it's looking to do in a more gradual and realistic process over the next few years, and indeed through to the end of the decade. But I would say that there's also, of course, that diplomatic defense element as well with the establishment of a British defense staff in Canberra, which will support the one in Singapore that currently exists. So, you know, you'll see both that tactical and also a wider diplomatic element being formed.
And this ties in many ways with the message or the vision of Britain as a global player, as a global power. And of course, there's a post-Brexit context to that as well. We may come back to that as we go. But I wanted to bring the Australian perspective in on the Indo-Pacific, because in many ways, I believe the British interest and British enhanced engagement with this region is welcome in Canberra. And I think it's welcome in much of the region, even if there's a little bit of scepticism as to how extensive it's going to be. From a geopolitical perspective, I'd say that in many ways, analysts and observers in the UK have become aware, sharply aware, in the past 1 or 2 years of trends that were noticed for a somewhat longer time here in Canberra and in other parts of the Indo-Pacific. And that is the trend towards Chinese coercion, the trend towards China being a source of risk as well as opportunity, or indeed a source of risk potentially outweighing the economic opportunities that China posed before. So, you know, I think the British tilt is welcome. And it's fascinating to see how much of the debate in the UK actually parallels, although comes somewhat after, the debate we've had in Australia, not only among security officials, policymakers, but also in the political class. Indeed, some of the things we hear out of the British Parliament on China can be a bit more robust than some of the messages we hear from Australian parliamentarians, and that is saying something, because a lot of that language is quite firm. So the UK has if you like, discovered or rediscovered the Indo-Pacific. There's also the European shift or tilt to the Indo-Pacific, France and other European powers, and that provides further context. And all of this is a useful backdrop to understand when we look at what happened in 2021. The AUKUS announcement, mid-September 2021, when the three prime ministers stood together virtually to unveil a real shift in policy towards direct cooperation on nuclear propulsion technology to support a future Australian submarine fleet, and stepped up cooperation across the full spectrum of critical technologies, cyber, quantum, artificial intelligence, and so forth, all with a very clear context of helping Australia to protect itself and to contribute to a balance of power that would prevent China from dominating the region. This stole the global headlines for a number of days and, of course, had all sorts of repercussions that we're still dealing with here in Australia in our relations with France and with Europe. But AUKUS, in a positive sense, is an affirmation of how close the Australia-UK relationship can be. So I think the question for us now is, having moved beyond a phase where I think both countries were taking one another for granted, and I think sometimes we, Britain and Australia, have had a habit of thinking they understood one another better than they actually did, suddenly we're moving into an era of great expectations, trilaterally with the Americans, but also in the bilateral relationship. And that's where whatever discussions are held this year between our officials and our ministers are going to be, I think, profoundly important for the future strategic orientations of both countries. So to produce the policy paper we've produced and we're publishing shortly, and to have convened the dialogue that we convened last year between non-government experts and government officials on both sides, the timing in some ways couldn't have been more fortuitous. What do you think, Vila, about all of this and about not only AUKUS as a signal of how close the Australia-UK relationship can be, but also the other ways in which that relationship may evolve? It would be useful maybe to delve into some of the ideas that we pursue in our paper.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that we highlight in the paper, which I think is a great basis, as well as the fact that you know, both the UK and Australia, one, have that longstanding historical relationship, a deep cultural understanding of one another. But I think also, you know, the fact that they are two middle powers as well, I think puts them on an excellent footing to find ways in which to cooperate. I would say that one area that I think is particularly important that we've explored is, of course, that element of science and technology, particular in outer space and cyberspace. Looking at some of these technological areas where both countries have clearly seen the need to invest both in their own national capabilities, but also in capacity building in other countries. I mean, if we look at cyberspace, for example, the fact that the UK has come out with £22 million for cyber capacity building, including in the Indo-Pacific, is an area where I think intention and ambition overlaps. The fact that, you know, these are areas in which norms and conventions have not yet been established, I think also offers opportunities for the UK and Australia to really leverage those values that they share to present a more concerted effort for collaboration and cooperation in promoting the principles that they hold central to how they view the international rules-based order. But Rory, I wondered what element you think particularly stood out as well as an area for cooperation for the two countries moving forward.
So look, I'd begin that by saying that I think there's often been a level of comfort between the two countries based on, I guess, you know, the intense trust that we have in the intelligence relationship and the long shared history, which goes without saying. that has sometimes led us to be a little bit complacent in our ambitions for the relationship. And I think that until recently, the fact that, you know, as you say, 5 or 6 years ago, the United Kingdom was so focused on China as a source of economic opportunity, and from our perspective, certainly from my perspective, was not seeing the level of risk coming out of China that Australian analysts were beginning to see. All of these factors led to a bit of underestimation of what we could achieve together. So the landscape has shifted, and I think now we need to look really objectively at one another's strengths and to look at that in an Indo-Pacific and a global framework, not only limiting it to, for example, the naval element, you know, the ships in the water, the military power projection that Britain is capable of and its limits, but also looking at those areas you've identified, cyber, technology, the protection of shared principles and values. I would actually place a very high emphasis on helping one another build capability and the role of people in all of that, because I think the human factor is something that obviously binds Britain and Australia and frankly a range of other like-minded countries as well. And what surprised me a little as we were conducting our dialogue and researching our paper is that I think we're undercooking the human factor. I think it should be normal practice that the Australian and British governments have very regular flows of secondees and exchanges between their bureaucracies so that we can develop at a day-to-day working level a shared awareness of each other's worldviews and sharing capabilities and expertise. I think that building a common pool of expertise on critical technologies, so in other words, ensuring that we minimise the bureaucratic barriers to research collaboration, to visits, visas, exchanges, and so forth, and that we really begin to treat our security, science, and industrial bases as broadly shared. I think there's a lot of promise there. I also would say that Australia needs to look pretty open-mindedly at Britain's engagement with the geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific. Britain is a substantial player in the Indian Ocean, less so in the Pacific. In fact, if you extend your definition of the Indo-Pacific to the Western Indian Ocean and the Gulf, it's not as if Britain ever left. And so I think we can find ways of leveraging Britain's footprint there, Australia's footprint further east, and begin to use the UK-Australia relationship as part of that wider web of democratic partners, the United States, of course, but also Japan, India, potentially France and other European powers, and we'll come back to that later on, ensuring that our forces have ready access to one another's facilities and bases, ensuring there's as much real-time intelligence sharing, and I'm sure between Australia and the UK that's one area where we do well, but really stepping that up and bringing in third and fourth countries. So I do see a pretty healthy set of ambitions ahead, but at each stage we have to, I think, guard against two risks. One risk is that risk of heightened expectation, that risk that somehow having under-delivered to each other for so long, except perhaps in the intelligence space, suddenly our political leaderships in both countries are perhaps pinning a little bit too much hope and expectation on the bond between Canberra and London. And the second risk is about perception, and it's about that perception that's already been engendered in various circles, that this is really just a revival of some stale Anglosphere, some club of English-speaking white people, and that this is, out of step with an inclusive approach to international affairs, or indeed the Asia-centric concept of the Indo-Pacific. I think there are ways in which we can guard against both of those risks, because I think particularly that Anglosphere perception is a bit misplaced, but we have to be mindful of that. What are your views?
No, I think that is completely right, Rory. I would agree with you that the Indian Ocean region is potentially a more natural part of the Indo-Pacific for the UK to really leverage its strengths, be that through the Commonwealth Network, be that through the defense facilities that it has dotted around the Indian Ocean region as well. But I think also just its relationship with the African littoral is something that Australia perhaps can look towards the UK for in terms of burden sharing. You've mentioned that the UK's presence in the South Pacific, for example, is not as strong. And I think that looking at this part of the world and seeing how the UK and Australia can best burden share is something that I think will help make sure that expectations remain more realistic on both parts, whilst simultaneously strengthening that bilateral relationship. I would also just in terms of perceptions, which I fully agree with in terms of, you know, the signal that some have interpreted through AUKUS that the Indo-Pacific now is going to be dominated potentially by an exclusive clique of Anglo-speaking countries is quite damaging and unhelpful. And this is an area where I think the UK and Australia have quite a lot of homework to do to find ways to bring back some of their mutual partners into the discussion and to find concrete ways to really move that relationship forward and to bring them in rather than unintentionally promote the perception that they're not welcome or that their role is being cast aside. And so I think when we look at ways in which countries, other European countries, for example, or even Japan can work with the UK and Australia on horizon scanning in the Indo-Pacific, on how they can work together on issues pertaining to supply chains or critical technology development. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we were talking about things like the D10 as an example of minilateralism.
And the D10 being the 10 democracies, right?
Exactly. So the G7 plus three, effectively. But if we also, you know, broaden this out to other existing multilateral frameworks or organizations like NATO, where the UK, Australia, and France, for example, and indeed Germany, can really work together to deepen discussions and understanding on the Indo-Pacific and think more critically about what NATO means for Indo-Pacific security and vice versa in the future. Those are, I think, all ways in which the UK and Australia can look towards those third parties and think more concretely about how to bring them in.
We'll be right back after this break.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What I'm hearing is that sense that while Australia and Britain together, Australia and the UK together, can have some real common strengths. I mean, let's face it, the world's 5th and 12th or 5th and 13th largest economies and defence budgets, that's two very substantial powers. At the same time, it's not going to be universally welcome if every initiative we undertake in the Indo-Pacific is a united front of Britain, Australia, and perhaps potentially other, supposedly Anglo-Saxon democracies. And I hear that, but I'd also note two things. One, just going to the very character of the two countries, these are actually two of the most multicultural countries in the world, and they're countries that define their national identity very much through values rather than history. So values rather than history or ethnicity. So I think that's a positive message that needs to be reinforced at every turn. But also, I think it's right to say that it would be counterproductive for every initiative that our countries undertake in the Indo-Pacific, that every initiative should be a joint initiative. There will be some areas where Australia is going to be better off prioritising its relationships with, if you like, geographically Indo-Pacific partners, with Asian powers. There will be areas where each country will play to its strengths, either alone or in other coalitions. But most interestingly for me, there are plenty of opportunities to coordinate with other groupings. And so, we've had some mention, I think, of the five power defence arrangements with Malaysia and Singapore and New Zealand. There's also, I think, the exciting prospect of how we can coordinate the Australia-UK relationship with the Quad, with the quadrilateral dialogue and all of the initiatives that the Quad has launched over the past 12 months. I mean, the Quad summits, the Quad initiatives on public health and vaccines, on climate and environment, on technologies, norms and standards there. You know, there's an enormous amount of work there that I think Britain can very logically coordinate with. And last of all, perhaps picking partners, nations like India, where Australia and Britain can coordinate some of their engagement. We can even look creatively, perhaps, at building new minilateral arrangements to harness convergent interests there. So, look, I think there are plenty of ways to manage those issues, but I think it is absolutely right to air publicly the criticism that's been made of AUKUS and the UK-Australia relationship so that we can better air it. And on that note of managing some of the risk or criticism, I would like to talk a little bit more about Europe. You've mentioned NATO already. The European Union itself has been, I think, very proactive over the past year or so in promulgating its own Indo-Pacific strategy, or essentially blueprint, and that was launched, unfortunately, from, I guess, our perspective, at the same time as AUKUS, or in fact, I should put that more appropriately, AUKUS was announced at the same time as the long-awaited EU strategy document. So we've now got some damage control, almost a kind of family feud in the family of democracies that want to protect their shared interests in the Indo-Pacific. And I think it's in Australia's and Britain's interests that we move as promptly and proactively as we can to ensure that that Australia and the UK engage with Europe, with France and other European powers as deeply and as often as possible as we move forward in the Indo-Pacific. What do you see as the opportunities and the risks there?
I mean, I think, first of all, I completely agree that there is a need for the UK and partners like Australia to work with European countries and the EU alike in the Indo-Pacific region. If you look at the EU and European strategy documents or guidelines for the Indo-Pacific, depending on what country you look at, and then you look at our respective objectives and values that we seek to promote in the region, I mean, there is an immense amount of overlap. And so it would be a waste of resources and a waste of a real opportunity if we didn't all find ways to really collaborate. But of course, as you have said and recognized already, there is some damage control to be done. I think this is not just because of AUKUS. I think this is also, of course, because of Brexit to a certain extent. And the UK is not necessarily looped in with the European Union anymore in the foreign policy communities there, at least at the EU level. So finding ways, firstly, to bridge that discussion is needed. And second of all, you know, there are areas like maritime security where the UK and the EU alike are looking to boost their participation and engagement in the Indo-Pacific. The EU, for example, is looking to extend CRIMARIA, which is a maritime domain awareness capacity building project, from the Western Indian Ocean region towards Southeast Asia. The UK similarly is looking at ways in which it can contribute to maritime security, capacity building, international maritime law training. These are all areas where, you know, significant financial resources can be devoted, but would be far better if there were coordination in that respect. Similarly, if we look at some of the defense assets, you've already mentioned the need to promote and to enhance facility access arrangements across partnerships. If we look at the assets that the Europeans, you know, have in terms of France deploying to the region, but then also the UK, there is rotational capacity there that could be explored. And to bring Australia into that as well, I think would enhance that persistent presence and continuous presence that like-minded countries are looking to ensure in the region. So, you know, there's lots that can be done, but that political will definitely needs to be there. And I think for that to happen, some real critical conversations need to be had towards rebuilding those relationships.
Look, I would like to think that as AUKUS develops, and AUKUS will be on two tracks, of course, there's the track to develop nuclear propulsion for Australian submarines, which is really an exclusively Australia-US-UK arrangement. But there's also the track for critical technology cooperation in all of these other areas, cyber, AI, and so forth, that some initiatives under AUKUS can in fact be developed with fourth or fifth or more countries. And so I think it's conceivable, for example, that in future we could see an AUKUS AI or cyber or quantum computing initiative where there is close research collaboration, trusted research collaboration with European partners, whether it's specifically with France or with Germany or other EU nations. And I would like to think that that is a diplomatic idea that that our governments should pursue, should develop in the months and years ahead. But there will be a lingering question of trust, and there will be, I think, lingering questions of whether, in fact, Australia and the UK feel that they can achieve what they need to achieve in the Indo-Pacific without Europe. And the answer to that, I believe, is no. Look, one other question before we wrap up is about the sustainability of all of this, the political sustainability. The Australian, UK and American leaders announced AUKUS last year. There's no secret that there's a pretty close political bond between the current governments in London and Canberra. But, of course, there's an election in Australia very soon, and the perpetual dynamism of democracy means that sooner or later the Australia-UK relationship and AUKUS more generally could well be in the hands of governments of different political persuasions, not the two conservative governments that that drove this initially. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we can build that bipartisan league of champions for the relationship, and that level of buy-in from elites, policymakers, policy communities in both countries, so that this is not simply a short or medium-term phenomena, that we really are reinvigorating the relationship for the 21st century.
Yeah, I think that's a really incredibly important point, Rory. I mean, I think when you speak about building bipartisan level buy-in, and when you speak about building that sustainability, you've already mentioned one really important point, which we address in the paper, which is that human aspect of it, that human capital aspect of it. I think a lot of this comes down to building greater awareness in the UK on the Indo-Pacific. Now, if you look at the trajectory of public opinion, for example, on China, that has drastically shifted. But if we ask that question about the Indo-Pacific, I'm not sure you'll get the same answer. And so looking at, you know, other political parties and their understanding of the Indo-Pacific, I think this is growing. But having those conversations at the parliamentary level, having those conversations in mixed working groups and expert communities between Australia and the UK to really further cement that understanding of why the Indo-Pacific is important, and more importantly, also how it directly impacts national security and national prosperity, is something that I think all sides of the political spectrum will be able to agree with, if that is an endeavor that's really pursued quite strongly.
That's a reasonably confident and optimistic note for us to pause our conversation on. I think we've covered a lot of ground in this discussion. I don't think we have any illusions about the challenges ahead for the relationship, the strategic partnership between the United Kingdom and Australia. It's not going to be, if you like, some kind of miracle solution to our strategic problems, but it's a really important pillar of that wider web of democratic solidarity and of solidarity in favour of a rules-based order globally. So I'm happy to pause it there. Any last thoughts from you, Vila?
I mean, just one more point, I think, on this discussion around how Europe and the UK and Australia can work together in the Indo-Pacific. I mean, you've mentioned the defense element of it, and we've discussed the foreign policy element of it more broadly. But I think one thing that should really be pursued by all sides is to not forget the importance of political signaling on the international stage. Joint communiques, for example, on areas of concern and developments of real concern in the Indo-Pacific, which we have seen in the past few years, particularly, for example, through the E3 framework, is something that does have impact and that does signal to both adversaries and allies alike that Europe and its partners are serious about this part of the world and are paying real attention. So even if we can't necessarily find, deep pockets for immediate projects, then I think at the very least, diplomatic signaling is something that we shouldn't forget and should continue to explore with Australia in the mix as well.
And I think you're talking there about issues like human rights, cyber attacks, and so forth, when you're talking about issues where we can and should coordinate our diplomatic signaling better.
Absolutely.
And I would just note one last thought that we may come back to in a future podcast here at the college, and that is the role of intelligence cooperation. I mean, I think we began this conversation by noting that intelligence cooperation, bilaterally, but also under the Five Eyes arrangement, is one area where the UK-Australia strategic relationship has been incredibly trusting and deep for decades. That doesn't mean that we can't do more in the intelligence space. And so one area that we'll be exploring in a future episode of the podcast is the future of the Five Eyes arrangement, and whether in fact Australia and Britain can work to extend that to additional countries, or whether we can add more than intelligence into the coordination among those five countries: Australia, the United States, the UK, Canada, and New Zealand. And of course, that in turn will raise new questions about the Anglosphere that I don't think we have time to deal with today. On that note, I think we should conclude this discussion. Vila, thanks for cooperating with the National Security College, not only in our podcast today, but in that very fruitful dialogue we convened under the Chatham House rule with experts from both countries last year, and also in our forthcoming publication. Thanks for being a champion of the Indo-Pacific in the United Kingdom.
Thanks, Rory. It was a real pleasure.
Well, that's it for today. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.